This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The U.S. Supreme Court agreed yesterday to hear a case that could have implications for a local teenager who's being held at an immigration detention center. At issue in the suit is whether people who have been detained for more than 6 months have the right to a hearing to argue for their release. Earlier this year, Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers detained 19-year-old Wildon Acosta as he was leaving his home in Durham. A judge ordered Acosta to be deported back to his native Honduras, and Acosta's been detained for nearly 5 months while he awaits an appeal. And advocates have questioned Acosta's treatment in detention. He's being held at the Stewart Detention Center, which is a private facility in Georgia operated by a company called Corrections Corporation of America. The company says Acosta was recently placed in restrictive housing for 9 days after being cited for 3 rule violations. Advocates for Wildon Acosta have compared restrictive housing to solitary confinement, and they question whether it was retaliation for the high-profile nature of his case. Democratic Congressman G.K. Butterfield of North Carolina has been an outspoken supporter of his appeal.
We're not going to secure Wildon Acosta's release without strong public support. And the advocacy is being demonstrated by his supporters, particularly in Durham County. has had a rippling effect and is being heard across the country.
Acosta's argument for refugee status makes matters even more complicated. He was one of more than 50,000 children from Central America who crossed our southern border as an unaccompanied minor in 2014. Most of them were fleeing violence in Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. We invited representatives of Immigration and Customs Enforcement and the Corrections Corporation of America to join the program. They declined, though ICE did provide us with a statement which reads in part, ICE focuses its enforcement resources on individuals who pose a threat to national security, public safety, and border security. I'm joined first by Evelyn Smallwood. She's an immigration attorney in Raleigh and represents Wildon Acosta. Evelyn, welcome back to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Also with us is Layla Santiago. She's a reporter for WRAL-TV, and she has been following the surge of immigration from Central America. Welcome back, Layla.
Thanks for having me.
Evelyn, can you tell us about the status of Wildon's appeal? Where is that right now? Because he's really got, in a sense, two cases going on, right? One for deportation because of his status as undocumented, but also he's asked for refugee status.
Exactly. So we have filed his application for asylum, which is currently pending with the asylum office, with the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. He has been fingerprinted on that case, which is the first step towards having his case heard at the asylum office. However, we are awaiting indication as to when he could be interviewed for that application, and obviously his detention is creating issues with that. And then, in addition, we have the motions to reopen that we filed earlier this year, which we have appealed. And there are actually two appeals pending simultaneously. We have submitted briefs on both of those appeals, as has the government. And at this point, we're waiting for the Board of Immigration Appeals to issue a decision.
So he's being held in detention. He was picked up because of his status. He's undocumented. ICE says it focuses on individuals who pose a threat to national security and public safety. So under what umbrella, why was he picked up and why is he being held, I guess, for deportation, right?
Correct. So he does have a removal order because he failed to attend his court hearing in March of last year, which is something that we have already discussed on your program. I'm actually curious to know, based on that statement that ICE gave you, where exactly they believe that Wildon falls into that list of people. If there is anything that we have proven through these months of advocacy, it is that he is not a threat to national security, public safety, or border security. And if anything, I believe that the public has spoken and the public wants him back. I mean, his community wants him here.
What have you heard about this restrictive housing, which is a form of solitary confinement? I think there's a little more freedom to come and go when you're not held, strictly speaking, in solitary confinement. But it's a punishment.
Indeed.
What was that about? What have you heard from Wildon about that?
So we were able to speak. First of all, I was able to speak with Wildon the day it happened, which was June 7th, which incidentally was the day before he was scheduled to graduate with his Riverside High School classmates. So, you know, in the context of knowing that instead of graduating, he was detained, he also got this punishment, this restrictive disciplinary housing. And the basis that he has been given and that he has given us for this was that he committed three moderate low-level infractions within 90 days, and those included not being where he was supposed to, not keeping his bedside table clean, and then apparently it was not following orders, but the order was for him to stop helping another inmate translate a letter from Spanish into English so that that inmate could communicate with his wife and children. And obviously, we as advocates and I as Wilden's attorney have some pretty strong feelings about those so-called violations and infractions. And it is our position, it has been from the beginning and will continue to be our position, that this was unacceptable. And the timing is obviously very suspicious, as it occurred the day before he was supposed to be graduating and only days after Congressman Butterfield's visit to the detention center.
And the congressman and others have suggested that he's actually being punished down there because of this. This has created a lot of publicity, his particular case, certainly in this area.
Absolutely. And Butterfield's office did release a statement on June 14th where they discussed that, and he had expressed his concern that the restricted housing was somehow in retaliation to the publicity that his case has received.
Well, I want to take a step back because, Layla, this case begins for Wilden in 2014, who, along with many, many others from Central America, poured into this country. And you covered that surge of immigration at the border. Tell us about that. And I know you've been back to talk about whether or not the immigration has waned and whether we're seeing another increase in that kind of immigration.
Right. So we saw sort of a high and a low, and now we're going right back up to that high. In 2014, we saw those numbers just rise and surge. And then 2015, those numbers went down significantly. Mexico stepped up its deportation orders. And then, we put on the U.S. put on quite the awareness campaign in the triangle, as they're called down there. So we're Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras. So there was certainly the effort to get those numbers down. But those numbers are climbing back up. In December, we saw a spike specifically for unaccompanied children. So that's what Wilden would fall under. And so we saw that spike in December. By January, DHS was already carrying out the immigration raids that we've reported on, those impacting people like Wilden. So we're not only seeing that those numbers come back up, but we're also seeing a little bit of a difference in who's actually coming. Still the Central American children, but also now it's not just the UACs, the unaccompanied children. We're also seeing children with family. That number has more than doubled last year. So the officials are aware. Already DHS has asked for more funding from Congress to help them shelter these children. Texas has extended the deployment of the National Guard at the border, the state National Guard. So they are very well aware that these numbers are coming back up, and as is often the case, we will likely see that during the summer. So that we haven't, those numbers aren't available just yet, but they're preparing for that.
So what's the sense that perhaps detentions like Wilden's are in some ways a part of this message to Latin American countries or Central American countries? We're taking this seriously. You're not going to get away with it.
Sure. I think, you constantly hear the president say, we've deported more people than any other administration. So they're certainly sending a message. And these headlines, depending on who you ask, sometimes, people want Wilden to get more attention so that they can get more community support. But at the same time, there are also those who fear we're sending the message that for deterrent purposes.
Right. And Evelyn, that also plays into the question of what the policy is. The policy is we're going to really focus on people who have demonstrated they are threats. But it does seem that perhaps part of this is a kind of public relations campaign.
Right. So just to build on what Layla has already said, if you look back beginning in 2014 when this so-called surge began, that was the immediate message that Jay Johnson had for these people and for the American public, is that, we will send you back. Right. And so with that as their goal of the administration, then that has been what has informed informed all of the decisions that they have made since. And so we see what they are doing to Wilden and to other children and teenagers like Wilden and to other families who are similarly situated with, you know, rounding them up, putting them back in detention, refusing to exercise their discretion to release them despite, you know, us providing more than ample evidence to prove that he doesn't fall within their priorities, is that they are continuing to push forward with this detention as part of that overarching theme of we will send them back.
And I can also add that I checked in with USCRI, so that's the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants, and they also speak to that. You know, why it's the classification. Are these refugees or are they not? You know, are they here because they are in fear for their lives because of the gang violence that so many have cited as the reason? And here locally, so the USCRI out of Raleigh will tell you that they come to North Carolina, many, to our state specifically, because, you know, agriculture, et cetera, et cetera. But the reasons they are citing for leaving, so the push-pull effect, is that gang violence. They don't believe that this is an economic immigrant. This is someone fleeing for their safety.
But, of course, you need to have a hearing to find that out, and it's pretty hard to do if you can't have access to an attorney in a detention camp.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is the issue that we've seen, is that, as we've spoken about before, there are two ways to be a refugee, and that's either before you get here or once you get here, to prove it with the courts. And when they have limited access to courts, to attorneys, then that's where the problems arise.
We'll talk more about those problems and the impact of private prisons and private detention camps as our conversation with Layla Santiago continues. Our WRAL reporter Evelyn Smallwood is Wilden Acosta's attorney. They will stay with us as we continue our conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. We're talking about the case of Wilden Acosta today, the 19-year-old undocumented immigrant still at a detention camp awaiting a hearing on whether he can stay in the country. Each year, Immigration and Customs Enforcement spends close to $2 billion on immigration detention. That's according to a report by the American Civil Liberties Union. The majority of immigrant detention centers are owned by private prison companies like the Corrections Corporation of America. Private prisons make about $3 billion a year, and more than half of that comes from immigrant detention centers. Still with us is WRAL reporter Layla Santiago. Evelyn Smallwood is here, too. She's an immigration attorney in Raleigh. She represents Wilden Acosta. And joining me now is Brian Hoffman. Brian led a group of attorneys to the Cara Family Detention Pro Bono Project in Dilley, Texas. That group represents hundreds of detainees at the largest family detention center in the country. Brian, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's great to be here with you, Frank.
Tell us a little bit about the detention center in Dilley. Who are you representing there?
So the detention center in Dilley is one of the largest overall immigrant detention centers in the U.S. It's about 55 acres and 2,400 beds. The population has fluctuated. We had about 2,100 detainees there last summer. I think it's something around 1,200 people detained there now. But even though this is called a family, ICE calls it a family residential center, we call it a detention center. The facility is only for women and children. So these are not actually families. There are no adult men. There are no older brothers. There are no uncles. This is women and young children. We represented clients from about 18 months of age to, I think, our older clients were in their early 50s. And as your other guests mentioned, these are almost all individuals from Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras.
In general or on average, how long do the families stay in the camp?
There was a big change in that actually last October. Prior to last October, we had clients who were there for months and months at a time. I couldn't give you an average, but we had clients who were there from anywhere from a few weeks to, we represented a woman who was detained for 14 months with her daughter. Last October, as a result of a federal lawsuit known as Flores versus Lynch, which is before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals right now, the government tried to cut down on the length of detention to try to put it at around 20 days. So now you do see most people in and out within several weeks, but that's as a result of a federal court order and not because the government ever acknowledged there was no need to hold these people for such a long period of time.
Well, what happens with most of them then? Are they deported more quickly or do many of them actually gain asylum?
No, as a matter of fact, very few people were actually deported from the facility. many people, when they're apprehended at the border, are issued papers which require them to go through what's called a credible fear interview. So they're issued documents saying you're not allowed to be here, but since you have claimed to be afraid to go back, you are going to be given this interview with an asylum officer. And the standard for passing the interview is whether you have a substantial possibility of winning your asylum case, ultimately. So between 89 and something like 96% of the clients we worked with were found to have a credible fear of persecution in their home countries. In other words, the government's own officials said there's a substantial possibility that you could win your asylum case in front of a judge. So it's not as though the government is finding that these people are just coming here to work. By its own acknowledgement, most of these people have a very good chance at proving that they are bona fide refugees deserving of asylum.
And yet,
most of them.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, yet in adult facilities like the one where Wildin Acosta is being held, you can be held for months without a hearing either on your deportation or on the asylum. Well, that, I guess, brings us back, Leila, to the question about the support here in Durham in Wildin Acosta's case. Again, this is a widely publicized case. There is some speculation that perhaps his solitary confinement was a punishment for bringing that much attention. Give us a sense of what happened here in Durham and in North Carolina when Wildin's case went public.
Well, certainly we've seen Congressman Butterfield has supported Acosta, and he's been very outspoken. But also you started to see rallies at the Durham City Council meetings. You started to see folks showing up there to speak out. And it wasn't just his family. I mean, oftentimes you'll see those closest or the Latino family, the Latino community. But this is where we saw Riverside High School pretty much come out. Teachers wrote letters. One specific interview that sticks out is we spoke to one of his teachers who had written a letter to President Obama. And he then wrote to Wildin and said, I want you to know that I've written the White House. I'm doing everything I can. And he had to stop the interview because he got emotional. This was also one of the teachers who took part in packages that were sent to Wildin with books and homework and worksheets. So teachers have really come out to say, hey, this is a good kid. We do not believe he is a threat to national security in any way. And his case in particular has seen more support of that here locally than some of the others that are similar.
It does raise the question, though, Evelyn, whether that works in his favor or not. I mean, if it's true, if the theory that he's being punished for raising awareness is true, then maybe it's not such a good thing.
You know, that question has been raised, but my position, and as his attorney, and I know the position of other advocates in the same situation, is that this attention absolutely helps. I mean, from the beginning, being able to have Congressman Butterfield involved, being able to have the community involved, being able to have educators involved, high school students involved, then it's absolutely helping Wildin, and it's helping me in my effort as his attorney, helping stop his deportations early on in the process. As recently as last week, there's a Huffington Post article written. I mean, you're talking about letters to Obama. I mean, this is a high school student, Morgan Whithouse. I don't know her. I wish I did. Where she writes an open letter in the Huffington Post to Secretary Johnson. And she talks about this, about how, you know, I'm a middle-class white American woman, a teenager, and this is going on, and this can't continue. So I think not only for Wildin, but I also think it draws attention to the greater issues as well. And just to kind of add on to what Brian was saying, I mean, I'm Wildin's attorney, and I believe in Wildin, and I agree with everything that Leila said about his teachers and his educators in this community. Wildin is a good kid. And Wildin deserves this attention, and Wildin deserves to be let out. But I would say, and I think Brian could probably speak to this as well, that Wildin isn't necessarily special. These are all good people.
Well, apparently, if you've gotten a 96% rate of people who would actually get asylum if they could get a hearing.
Absolutely.
And not be in a camp for 7 or 9 months. So, Brian, what are the conditions in that camp while they're being held? Can you give us a sense of what's going on in Dilley?
Sure. So the Dilley facility, it's got very high fences all around it. It's very much a secure facility. The doors to enter and exit the different modular buildings have buzzers and steel locks. you have to go through security checks to be allowed in to begin with. There is no barbed wire on the top of the fences. The government likes to point that out because the government essentially argues this is a short-term processing facility. We're just kind of putting people up for a short period of time to process their cases. But in fact, working with these people, you see the psychological toll that detention takes on them. There's a saying in Spanish, which I guess in English would be a gilded cage is still a cage. It's not so much the conditions of the detention. Yes, people complain about the food. Yes, they complain about the treatment. Yes, they complain that they can't access their attorneys and outside experts as they would be able to if they weren't detained. But the psychological toll, more than anything, really weighs on these people. And you see it in the interactions between the mothers and their kids. One client who I talked to last summer, I thought put it very succinctly. She said, you know, there are toys here. There's a soccer field. There's a gym. But the kids don't play with the toys. They sit around and talk to each other, 6-7-year-olds, and say, what did your lawyer tell you? When do you get to go in front of the judge? How much is your bond? And that is not what a child's life in America should be, regardless of whether it's an American child or a refugee child.
Evelyn?
Yeah, I would say just to bring that back to Wilden and this solitary confinement issue and how CCA is trying to pretend that this wasn't solitary confinement. And you have to take the context of you have this kid, this teenager, who has committed no crime, has been charged with no crime, has been convicted of no crime, and who is essentially in jail. And then on top of that, he's in, as Brian said, he's in, you know, this cage. And then they're going to restrict him even more. And I got a list of, you know, what could constitute a low-level offense. And basically one of them is obscenities. And you do 30 and 90 days. So you're telling me that you swear 3 times in 90 days, then not only are we depriving you of your freedom of being outside, but we're going to even deprive you more now that you're inside. And the psychological toll is true. It's incredible.
Layla?
And there's actually also a bit of restrictions for media. I actually asked to go with Congressman Butterfield, and his office obviously didn't have an issue with it, but we were told, no, this is a congressional visit, no media allowed. So we have not had access to go in and see that. I'm willing to do it. You know, I said, look, I'll drive down, fly down, whatever. But we have not had access to Stewart anyway. For to go see that for ourselves. And we've been told even if you get an interview with him, it will be in one room, and you yourself cannot go in with cameras to the facility. So it's a lot unseen, I think.
Right. And so it's hard to make decisions, policy decisions at the public level if you don't really know what's going on. Brian, tell us a bit about the access for attorneys and how it is for an attorney. We can talk to Evelyn about this too, but I'd like to hear, in your case, working at a family detention center, what it's like for a lawyer to get access and how you can actually build a case or if there are any restrictions on you.
Yeah, it's challenging. And part of the issue is that the Dilley facility is also owned by Corrections Corporation of America. This is the same company that owns the facility where Wilden is detained. And so not only do you have the enormous bureaucracy of the Department of Homeland Security, you have an enormous corporation like CCA, which, you know, breaks in billions of dollars in revenues every year. That bureaucracy is sort of added on to the existing government regulations. So attorneys would have to, in advance, submit copies of their driver's licenses, of their cards showing that they're admitted to the practice of law. Non-attorney volunteers would also have to submit different identity documents. And in some cases, ICE would actually come back and say, no, here are some of your volunteers that we are not going to permit to enter the facility, without ever really justifying why they were banning those people from helping out in the representation. So litigating a detained case is exponentially more difficult than a non-detained case.
Can CCA impose any restrictions that, I mean, I would assume that they have to operate under federal guidelines. They can't make up their own rules, or can they?
No, they can't, but the access point itself has become sort of a crucible where going into the facility every morning, you have court starting in an hour, you've got 20 cases, and all of a sudden CCA is saying, oh, wait, we read this rule to now say that you can't bring your laptop in, and this person can't come in at all, and this other person is not dressed appropriately. We're saying, look, we're attorneys. We know what we're doing. These are our legal assistants. We have court starting very soon. We don't have time to deal with this constantly changing sea of rules and restrictions on access to the facility. To just give you one quick example, we were getting a lot of complaints that would change on a daily basis, but would be things like your volunteers have high heels on that are too high, or underwire bras are no longer allowed in the facility because they're dangerous. And when we asked CCA to provide a comprehensive copy of the rules it was citing to, they said, well, that's actually proprietary information. We can't give you a copy of the rules that you're expected to follow. So it just sort of illustrates the bureaucracy that we're all operating in here.
Well, and the idea of the private prisons, we can talk about the rules that have incentivized them in terms of the way they're funded, and I know you've looked into that. There are some incentives for keeping people detained. Obviously, if you're a private corporation, you need to keep those beds full. Brian, am I right?
Well, right. And what might be surprising is when you look at CCA's quarterly revenue reports, there's really no attempt to obfuscate this at all, that more people locked up is more revenue for this company. In fact, they, in their first quarter 2016 revenue statement, say that their Dilley detention facility generated about $70 million in revenue just during the first quarter of 2016. And then they talk about how lower incarcerated populations at other facilities would offset that revenue increase. So it's very clear, the more people the government locks up, the more money this corporation makes.
Evelyn, is it clear to you at all, or does it occur to you at all, that the privatization of this of detention makes things more complicated for you or not? I mean, this is also a matter of public policy, and the public policy has been pretty clear about sending a message, et cetera. That comes from the government and not from detention centers. So I wonder to what extent the privatization of detention complicates or not your job.
Right. So my job specifically, I would say that it absolutely complicates it. And I think that you can take this example again of Wilda being put in quote unquote restrictive disciplinary housing or solitary confinement, that when I, as his attorney, was seeking to get information about what had been done to him and why, then I was kind of, you know, I was able to be given the runaround because of these two different agencies that are involved, ICE and then this huge corporation, the CCA. And at one point I said that they would be willing to give me those documents. But then after having a conversation with CCA, then it became clear that ICE was not going to be giving me those documents. And then my request kind of went ignored. And so just something as simple as, you know, understanding why this is going on, then they're kind of able to shift blame on one another in a sense as well. And so absolutely, besides the overall policy issues that I see as far as privatizing prisons, like Brian said, and like in Wilden's case, just on a practical level as an attorney, it absolutely complicates things.
As we said, we reached out to both ICE and the Corrections Corporation of America to join us on the program. Both declined. They have sent statements. We've read part of those statements on the program. Brian, you've talked about the fact that families are often split up between adult and family centers. Tell us more about that and whether or not it affects what you do.
Right. So I think the best way to illustrate this is with an example of a case I worked on last summer while I was in Dilley. A young woman from Mexico came to the border, asked for asylum. In her case, she actually had over 100 pages of evidence showing all of the abuse that she suffered at the hands of her husband, who was a member of a criminal organization. She was with her three children, two sons who were citizens of Mexico and one daughter who was a U.S. citizen, and she was with her mother. And as the decision was made somehow to detain this family, despite all of the evidence they had that they had a meritorious case, the little girl, the U.S. citizen, ended up with distant friends of the family in Texas. Mom and the two boys are at the family detention center. Grandma ends up getting sent to an adult detention center in Florida. And now all of a sudden it's this family's problem to connect all of their cases back together, find representation for the different members, and present what is essentially the same claim for relief in front of different judges all over the country, which cannot be an effective use of either judicial or enforcement resources.
Evelyn?
Just to add to that as well, and again, Brian can speak to this, but the trauma that is involved with these children watching their family be torn apart is remarkable and horrific, honestly. And when you talk to these children and you talk to them about episodes that have had an impression on them, then they will all, if they're a member of one of these families that has had their father taken away or their grandmother taken away or have been gone to live with strangers, then that is absolutely has a psychological impact on them that is difficult to to fix.
You know, the ACLU has done research on alternatives that are already being piloted to detention. They have to do with in-home arrest and collars and this sort of thing. And it's fascinating, at least in terms of cost. We're looking at right now anywhere between $162 to $265 a day in detention versus 17 cents to $17 a day, with a slight roll-off on the number of people who actually show up. So you lose a few people with these alternatives, but I wonder if you've heard about any of the alternatives and whether or not they could be more closely explored. Certainly some of them are going on, and it's in an ACLU report. I've only got about a minute left, but Layla, at the border, you talked about, let's talk about policy, because I know you've taken a look at how things have changed since 2008. Things gotten more restrictive, more lenient. Is there a way to look at how policy has changed over the past 8 years?
Well, specifically at the border, we're starting to just see how they, I'm not sure tackle is the right word, but how they approach apprehensions. It used to be that they all went into one facility, and now you're starting to see that they're keeping the women and children on one side, and then sometimes just the children in one area. So you've certainly seen, given the numbers increase, I think right around 2008 is, if you look at the long 20-year, I think right around 2008 is when we started to see those numbers go up. And I think in the southwest portion of the border, so we're talking about the Rio Grande Valley, they certainly had to make a lot of changes in just how they approach this.
And you say they're beefing up enforcement again in anticipation of another surge. It'd be interesting to see what would happen if instead of enforcement you beefed up the adjudication process, which when it gets through, Brian, apparently shows that most people really do deserve refugee status. Interesting stuff. I'm out of time, sadly, but I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Evelyn Smallwood, Brian Hoffman. Evelyn Smallwood is an immigration attorney in Raleigh and represents Wilden Acosta. Brian is an attorney that led a group representing detainees at a family detention center in Dilley, Texas. And Layla Santiago is a reporter for WRAL-TV News. Thank all of you for being on the program.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Frank.
Thanks, Frank. It's been a treat.
Coming up, new highlights, actually highlights from a new film about a sculptor who uses the earth as a cast. Stay tuned.